Amen. Thank you, worship team. And children, you may be dismissed to your classes. So today we're going to be looking at the Gospel of Luke, chapter 13. Luke 13, verses 31 through 35. Just at that time, some Pharisees approached him, saying, "Go away, leave here, for Herod wants to kill you." And he said to them, "Go and tell that fox, 'Behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I reach my goal. Nevertheless, I must journey on today and tomorrow and the next day, for it cannot be that a prophet would perish outside of Jerusalem. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together, just as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not have it. Behold, your house is left to you desolate, and I say to you, you will not see me until the time comes when you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" One of the things in the New Testament that we all understand and we all realize is that we have this division, this separation, this competition, if you will, if you want to use that term, even though it's not really a competition because the battle was already won. But we have this issue between the Pharisees and Jesus, the leaders of the church and Jesus. And you see what's happening continuously with this taking place is that the Pharisees are trying to find a way that they can trap Jesus. They're trying to find a way they can get Jesus. They're just after Jesus. And so every single time a Pharisee opens their mouth, they're just finding a way to get Jesus, to get at him. So we want to make one thing clear at the very beginning of this passage when you see the Pharisees saying, "Hey, Jesus, hurry up and leave because Herod wants to kill you." They really were not concerned about Jesus' welfare. They really were not concerned making sure that Jesus would survive or that Jesus would live or that there would be no damage done to him. You see, every time a Pharisee opens their mouth, there's a motivation behind it increase their desire or increase what they want, and there's a selfish motive hidden behind it. So I like Jesus' response because you can tell at this moment, and I don't think that this is the idea of Jesus getting to that human stage like you and I would where we're starting to snap and we're starting to lose it, but it seems like that's where Jesus might be to a certain degree because he's looking at the Pharisees and he's saying, "Go tell that fox, I'm going to continue to do what I'm doing and basically no one's going to stop me." In other words, Jesus was on to the Pharisees' game. He saw what they were after. He knew what they desired from the beginning. And from the very beginning of the early church fathers, if you look at the early church father writings, and we're talking way back when before 1054, you have these early church writings where they had connections to Jesus. They either knew somebody who knew Jesus personally or they knew Jesus themselves personally because of that early on writings that they took that they did. And if you look at any of them, all of them are saying basically the same thing, was that Jesus understood what the Pharisees were after. He understood what they were going. He understood what their desire was, and he wasn't going to give in to it because Jesus had his own mission. But the interesting thing about that, as we've said before, is that that mission that Jesus had was he was giving up his life. He was surrendering. He was pouring out his life. And so the Pharisees are trying to find a way to trap Jesus. How can we get Jesus? They're over here devising a plan. How are we going to get Jesus? And then over here is Jesus, and he's saying, "I'm giving up my life." The Pharisees are thinking they got him when actually he gave himself up. They never did get him as they thought they did because he just gave his life up. He's surrendering, and that's why when they came with the clubs and the swords in the Garden of Gethsemane, what did Jesus say? He's like, "Did you guys really think you needed to bring the clubs and swords?" as if I was leading some kind of a rebellion? Do you really think that that's necessary? Because you've seen me. You've seen me teach. You've seen me preach. I've never done anything violent. I've never had that. And I'm giving myself up. And so we have this contrast of the Pharisees and Jesus. And in this particular story, Jesus responds and he says, go tell that fox, I'm going to continue to do what I'm doing. I'm going to continue to cast out demons. I'm going to continue to do this. And it doesn't matter what Herod wants or what anybody wants or what you want, Pharisees. It doesn't matter what anybody desires or what anybody wants. I'm going to continue to do this. So the first message we get from that, the first clear application is, number one, you can't, and I emphasize can't 100%, you can't stop Jesus. You can't. It doesn't matter how. Go ahead and try. You're not going to stop him. Pharisees are trying to devise a plan. They're trying to find a way to stop him. Herod probably is after him, trying to stop him. It doesn't matter. You can't stop him. You cannot stop Jesus. And it's just amazing, the more we think about this, that they thought that they actually could, that they thought they had the power to do so. So as Jesus responds, he says this amazing thing. If we skip ahead to the next slide, please. And he says in verse 34, this is a powerful statement that Jesus makes. He says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And of course, this is happening after in verse 33. He says, for it cannot be that a prophet would perish outside of Jerusalem. And then he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And the idea of him saying, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, it's a burden that he has for them. It's a crying out that he has. It's the idea that he has pity for them. He's split right down the middle. He's torn over them. You could pretty much put tears in his eyes while he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And I want us to think about the times in our life where we have said that about somebody else. Maybe it was a city the same way in Jerusalem, or somebody else that we knew could be better, or that we knew could follow Christ, but they weren't, or that they were rejecting it. And we would say, oh, and then we would repeat their name twice, like, oh, I don't understand. Why is this not happening? Oh, your life could be so much better if you would just do this. And Jesus is looking at this city and he's saying, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And then he explains, he says, the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to her. So from the beginning, he's saying that the idea is that the Jerusalem, the leaders of the church from Jerusalem, they kill the prophets and they stone those sent to her. Why are they killing the prophets? They don't want to hear what the prophets have to say. So they're going to try to find a way to kill the prophets. And they're going to try to find a way to kill the messenger. They don't realize that the issue's with the message. They think the issue's with the messenger. And this went all the way into the New Testament, the idea of killing the prophets, when we have the story of John the Baptist. And you remember the story of John the Baptist. John the Baptist, here he is, and he does not pull any punches. He calls out sin and calls it what it is, and he doesn't even try to candy coat it at all. And most likely some of his close advisors, if John had any advisors, which I'm not sure he did because he was pretty desolate and on his own quite a bit. But if John the Baptist had any advisors, on this one day, they probably were coming into his office and saying, John, please, today, just tone it down today. Please, the king is here, okay? The king is sitting up front. Please, just tone it down today. Don't go off on your big sin thing. Don't go off on that. Just let it go for one day. And what does he do? He points out the king's sin publicly of what was happening. And so what does the king do as a response? Oh, wow, he's right. I should change that behavior. I am wrong. No, what does he do? Well, I'm going to lock him up in prison, so I don't have to hear about my sin anymore. I lock up the prophets so I don't have to hear about my sin. So that's what Jerusalem's problem was, as Jesus is pointing out here, that they would stone the prophets, they would get rid of the messenger, they would do everything possible to not hear about the sin that they had. And Jesus is using this great analogy when he says this. He says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together, just as a hen gathers her brood under her wings. Now, think about this for a moment. This is Jesus. He's talking to Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often have I wanted to do this? Now, there are some theological stances that we can take on these concepts. There are some ideas that we can have. But the idea, first of all, that we need to understand is that throughout the Old Testament, we could make the case that God was making an attempt to, man fell. All right, this is how we fix it. Obey the sacrifices. Make the sacrifices. Obey the commandments. Man fell. This is how we fix it. You need to fix this. You need to do it this way. Bring the sacrifices in this way. And God's trying to find a way to bring back that relationship that was broken, that relationship that was lost once sin entered the picture. And God's trying to do that. And look at Jesus, who's saying, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. It was mentioned earlier today when the worship team was up here, the idea of, is Jesus in the Old Testament? Okay? Is Jesus in the Old Testament? And I want all of you to nod your heads, please. Yes, because he is. Jesus is in the Old Testament. He's all the way through the Old Testament. And why is it that Jesus is in the Old Testament, or how is it that Jesus is in the Old Testament? Well, first of all, the Gospel of John lets us know that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then later on in that same chapter, the Word became flesh, and he's talking about the person of Jesus who became flesh, which means that Jesus is God. It's the same idea when you have the question, and I think we grow out of this question, I think, when people ask the question, what does God look like? Anybody ever ask you that? Child, most likely. What does God look like? What does he really look like? I heard a perfect answer from that. I can't take credit for it. I didn't come up with it. Somebody else said it's very clear. Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. That's what God looks like. God looks like Jesus. Why? He is Jesus. He is God. Jesus is God. And so when he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often, he's not talking about just the 30-some years that he was on this earth physically and walking amongst mankind, although that's included, but he's talking about in the Old Testament that Jesus himself is looking and saying, how often have I wanted to see you thrive? How often have I wanted to see our relationship get back together the way it was at the beginning? How often have I desired to see this happen? How often have I longed to see this take place? And what does he say? And you would not have it. It's almost as if he's in that last chance mode. It's almost as if he's in that mode of, this is the final shot, guys. Come on. One more chance. I have wanted to see you, but you would not have it. I have wanted to gather you together as a hen gathers their chicks. Think about that for a moment today. Because that analogy alone kills a lot of bad perceptions that we have about God. It's in our world today. Because we have bad perceptions about God. We talked about that at the 9 o'clock hour. There are bad perceptions about God. Most likely, you probably heard a bad perception about God sometime this week. Maybe not just one, maybe several. Somebody gave a warped perspective on God, on the person of God. Because when we were talking 9 o'clock, we're talking in 1 John where he says, God is light, in him there is no darkness at all. But yet our culture tends to run along the lines of, well, yeah, but you know what? I don't know if I believe in God because look at everything that he permits. Look at everything that he allows. Why is there all this destruction in the world? Why is there war taking place? Why is there poverty? So you know what? I'm not even going to serve God if that's who God is. Well, that's because we have a bad perception of God. Because the bad perception of God is that somehow he's not all light. He's not all holy. But there's a little bit of darkness in God. Or maybe half darkness in God. Or there are those you might run into or who would even say that God is completely dark or God is evil. Or I've had different people come up to me at times, especially younger ages, saying that God is mean. So there's always these whole bad perceptions of God. And I want us to think about what are those bad perceptions and how can we fix those bad perceptions? Because usually the way they can be fixed is when we say, well, are you talking about the God of the Bible? Because if you're talking about the God of the Bible, let's look at that. And they say, well, why would God allow the killings in the Old Testament? Well, we can explain that. We can explain the whole thing all the way through, how God is still pure and still holy, even though those things took place. But it's the idea of the perception of God that I think we forget at times. But look at this perception of God that Jesus is giving, because this is God, this is Jesus, and he's saying, how often have I wanted to gather your children together just as a hen gathers under her wing? How often I've wanted to do this. And he's talking about from the beginning. He's talking about once Eve took the fruit, man, Jesus desired to bring them back in. But as he said, they wouldn't have it. So I began to think about this whole thing, and I started thinking about religion and started thinking about God and how we view God and how we view religion and how we view church and how we view Christianity. And I would say there's different concepts. And some of the concepts that I understand that are out there is the idea of what I would call the holding God at arm's length concept. That, yeah, I believe in God and everything, and I believe he exists, and I believe he created the world, and I believe he, but, you know, he's God. You know, I'm here, but he's God. I don't have anything to do with him. He just does what he does. He created the world, and I just kind of keep him here. And what happens with that is that as soon as somebody comes along and says, hey, you know what, how about you have a closer relationship with God? No, I'm fine right here. I'm fine. I don't really want God too much involved in my life. I'm fine right here. I don't want it too close. It's kind of like a child growing up and the time when the parents leave because they think the kids are old enough to watch the house, and something happens, and what do? Usually something happens. Almost always something takes place. Something happens, and usually there's a little bit of cover-up that is attempted so that would not take place. Sometimes it's a pushing of a chair. Sometimes a pushing of a couch just to cover up that spill that to make sure that the parents didn't see. That's the kind of the same idea. You're just holding God out here. But I understand why somebody would want to do that, because the whole idea of doing this is I really don't want him in here, because if he's in here, then he knows more about me. He knows who I am. He knows what my motivations are. He knows my heart. He knows my thoughts. And so I'd rather have him here. I remember in college we took the personality tests. And I remember this was probably when it was just starting to get popular that everybody was taking these tests, and it was the Myers-Briggs. Has anybody here ever taken anything called the Myers-Briggs? Has anybody ever disagreed with the results of your personality test? I remember I tried to, and they told me no. They said no. No, this is right. This is who you are. But so I've been labeled over the years. I've been labeled as an extrovert, but I've also been labeled as an introvert. And I don't know if it's possible to be both, but I would say I'm somewhat both. I remember in our first church, I began to learn about that because I started to see how I was personality-wise and my behavior-wise, and how people would stop over to see me, and I would say hi and stick my head out and say, have a nice day, thank you, and kind of close the door. That was the introverted thing. Anybody here ever? Am I the only one that's ever? You know, I just like to keep to myself. But the problem is that we can't do that with God, or at least that's not what God desires. You see, because what Jesus is asking here is, Jesus is saying, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, for generations since the fall of man, you've kept me here. And how often have I wanted? How often have I desired? How often have I called your name and said, oh, if I could just bring you back in where you belong, where you need to be? How often? often? How often did I see what you were doing? How often did I see the disobedience that you were involved in? How often did I see how you were bringing up sacrifices with blemishes? How often did I see the destruction that was happening to your people if you would have just listened to and if you would have just came in? How often have I wanted to see you? You see, that changes the perception of God. See, because the idea of God being mean and God being out to get us and God out to destroy our life and God to take all the fun away and all those. No, Jesus doesn't want that. Jesus just wants, hey, how often have I wanted to do this? But then he says, but Jerusalem, you wouldn't let me. I've done all I know to do. I've done everything. I've said everything I know to say. But, oh, Jerusalem, you still, I would send a prophet to give you the truth. A prophet would give you and come and proclaim the sin that was going on in the camp. I would send a prophet, and what would you do? You would stone the prophet because you wouldn't want to hear the voice. Oh, and oh, king, would you please listen to what John the Baptist is saying. He's telling you the truth. Don't put him in prison. Don't try to stop the message. That's me trying to get across to you the truth. If you could just somehow come. And that's what he desires for everybody. I mean, we know in Peter, it's not his will that any should perish, but that all should. You don't suppose that throughout all of our time here on earth, that from the time we're born, that this is what he's doing? That from our birth all the way to our physical death, Jesus is, come on. Come on, Chad. Stay under here where you belong. Don't go wandering out all these other things and stay under here. From our birth all the way to, and you don't suppose that those circumstances in our life that we don't understand or that frustrate us, you can argue about whether he caused them or whether he didn't cause them or whether he allowed them or whatever. You don't suppose that those ones that kind of rub us the wrong way, that just might be his way of saying, remember, as long as you're wandering out here and you're not under my wing, that's what it's going to be like. Your life's going to be a disaster. It's all going to be if you would just come back into where you're designed to be. Now, there's another aspect to this whole thing, and that's the analogy that Jesus is using. I guess it's self-esteem. I don't know if what phrase you want to use or what term you would want to use, but I would almost say that if you want to have good self-esteem, don't read the New Testament. I would almost say that. But of course, it depends on how you define self-esteem. If you define self-esteem as I'm number one, I'm looking out for myself, I have confidence in myself and in my abilities, and I can accomplish whatever I want, whatever I desire, if I set my mind to it, I can be whatever, I don't need anybody's help, I don't even need God's help. If you define self-esteem that way, then yeah, don't go to the New Testament because you're not going to find that. Because you remember what Jesus refers to us as, right? We're sheep. And what does that mean? I talked to a sheep farmer years ago who explained that to me. And he said it, and I'll quote him, sheep are dumb. He just said it straight out. Jesus says you're sheep. I don't need to finish that thought. You can finish it on your own. Then that must mean you are. And he also said, I remember him saying this very clearly. He said, you know, sometimes the sheep are so dumb that I have to get out this club. What did Jesus say when he was talking to the disciples? And he said, he looked over and he was burdened over Jerusalem, and he said, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. He said he looked over, they were like sheep without a shepherd. So the same idea is here, is the idea of him using the analogy of chicks coming under the hen's wing and gathering them together. Because the problem is, and I'm just going to go out on a limb, and maybe you're not, maybe you don't have this issue, but I would suggest that probably anybody with a pulse has this issue, is the problem is none of us naturally like the idea of being sheep. In which I would say probably none of us naturally like the idea of being dumb. And none of us naturally like the idea of being chicks coming under the hen's wing. And why is that? Well, the opposite of sheep and the opposite of chicks is what? The opposite is we know. We don't need any help. We don't need any guidance. We have our own self-esteem. Look out for number one. We can accomplish it. We can do whatever we want. We don't even need God's help. We're fine. We don't need anything. We got this. We're good, and we don't even need. And so the problem is we know. And so that's kind of what took place when Eve is there and Satan is tempting her, the serpent is tempting her and saying, you know, God didn't say that. God said this. And he's just afraid that if you take the fruit that you're going to be like him. And he doesn't want you to be like him. And that's the only reason. And what does Eve do? Eve says, oh, she looks at it and she sees that it's pleasing to the eye. Well, it can't really hurt. At that moment, she drifted on from under the wing. And she takes the fruit and she gives some to Adam. And then they stopped thinking. And they became dumb. Let me explain. Oh! We took the fruit. Oh, God told us not to. Eve, why'd you do that? It was a serpent. Oh, I did it too. What are we going to do? I got it. We're going to hide from God. What happened? When you took that fruit, something happened. How do you think that's going to work out, Adam and Eve? I mean, you know who God is, right? I mean, you've been with him now for how long, and he's walked with you, and you know who. You really think you're going to be able to hide from? We hear him. He's coming. Oh, he's almost here. Oh, there's his voice. Where are you? We were naked, so we hid. Again, don't you think he knew that? And then what's God say? Who told you you were naked? Did you eat from the tree? Even though he already knew that. And so I would suggest that at that moment when she took the fruit, that was the beginning of dumbness. That's when it started. Right? If anybody wants to know, if you're looking around our culture today and you say, boy, that is dumb. Or you say, boy, that person is dumb. I would tell you that started when Eve took the fruit. Because there's no longer is there wisdom from God. Now we're dealing with the wisdom of mankind. And if you haven't noticed yet, the wisdom of mankind is dumb. History class in high school. I remember this vividly. The reason I remember it vividly because I took this one history class 3 times. I liked it so much. But they made the statement. I heard this 3 times in the world history class. 3 times, same statement every time was that what's the important reason why we study history? Why do we study history? So we don't repeat the same mistakes the previous generations made. And how many years have we been studying history? And how's that working out for you? Why? Because we're dumb. Mankind without God's wisdom, we're a disaster. We're a mess. We don't make any sense. There's no logic involved at all when we don't have God's wisdom. And that's what took place. She takes the fruit, the dumbness enters the world, and now all of a sudden everybody's roaming around and they think they have it all together. They think they're wise. They think they're smart. They think they're intelligent. And the whole time they're just flat out dumb. Remember what the Apostle Paul said? The wisdom of this world is foolishness to God. And so that's where all this happened. And so, but in order to be a sheep or in order to be a chick, what do you have to do? You kind of have to admit, number one, you have to admit that, sorry, you're gonna have to admit you're dumb. And you're going to have to say, I don't know. I wonder how many times, if that would have happened when Moses is up on the mountain and they're building the golden calf, if somebody would have just stopped and said, I don't know. Why don't we ask God first? Jesus comes then in the New Testament, and I wonder if the Pharisees, every time they're trying to trap Jesus, if some Pharisee would have just spoke up, if just one of them would have said, wait, guys, this is really dumb. I'm not sure if we should be illegal trial. We're going to put him on the cross, illegal trial at night. I wonder what the difference would have been. And that's why Jesus is saying, come on, it's okay to be dumb. It's okay to admit that you're dumb. It's okay that you admit that you need a shepherd. It's okay that you need to be under a wing. It's okay to admit you can't live this life on your own without him, or it would be a disaster. But the biggest problem we have is the same problem Jesus ran into when he's talking to Jerusalem, when he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, from the beginning, from the fall of man, how I have wanted this relationship with you. I've wanted this closeness because I know what's best for you. I know where you belong. I know what needs to happen. But you refused. And you said, I don't want it. And I'll continue to stone the prophets. And I'll continue to put the prophet in jail. Because I don't want it. And I don't desire it. I want to ask about you today. You think there might be any possibility in your life right now that Jesus might be saying this to you? I mean, he's not saying Jerusalem, Jerusalem, but maybe he's calling out your name, and maybe he's saying, it may even be a case where, you know what, Chad, I've been there before, and I remember being where I'm supposed to be. I remember being designed where I'm supposed to be designed. I remember living there, but Chad, for some reason lately, I've kind of drifted out from his wing, and I'm just going around, and maybe he's calling you back into. It's time to come back in and realize that you're not as smart as you think. Stop acting like you know it because you don't. The truth is we're all sheep, you're all chicks, and you all need to come under my wing, and the only hope you have is coming under my wing. And stop drifting out from this, because that's always going to be a mess, and you know it's going to be a mess. Every time you've drifted from the wing, you've always been a disaster. Come on. So how would you define your Christianity today? How would you define your walk with Christ? Is it, I believe in God, he's good, and he created everything, but I have my life, he has his, and I just kind of keep him? Or would you explain your Christianity today as, I'm under his wing. He has me close. He's embracing me. Because if you're not there, let me tell you, there's a person who wants you there more than you ever would, and his name is Jesus, and he's calling that out now for with every bit of his being, saying, come on, would you please come here? And maybe you're here this morning, and maybe you have never made the decision to follow Jesus, and you aren't a follower of Jesus, and you don't even understand what this means. You can take it today that he's definitely screaming out at you, saying, how often I wanted you here, how often I've desired to have you here. Would you come and be where you are designed to be? I think that would be the best question to ask. If I'm ever in my life and I have a frustration or I have an issue I don't understand or I don't get it or whatever it might be, I think the first question to ask would be to look around and say, okay, before I go any further on finding an answer on how to solve this problem before me or what I'm facing, am I under his wing? Because if I'm not, then all I'm going to be dealing with is man's wisdom, which we have already concluded, which is dumb, and the Apostle Paul says is foolish. Lord Jesus, we thank you today for who you are and for everything that you mean to us. We ask God today that you would show us your desire and your hunger for each of us. You aren't out to get any of us. You aren't out to ruin our lives. You're not out to take our fun away. You're not out to do anything like that. You have a longing from deep in your heart for every single person to be under your wing. And Jesus, I say today, forgive me for all the times that I drifted from that wing, where I thought I could do it on my own, and I thought my wisdom, which was foolishness, was good enough, and everything that I thought I could do. And the whole time you're saying, come here, under my wing. How often have I wanted to put you there? May we not be like those in Jerusalem on that day, where Jesus said they would not have it, they refused it, they rejected it. May we be the opposite and say, Jesus, yes, we'll take it. Jesus, put me under your wing, because, man, Jesus, I am so tired of trying to live my life without you. Lord Jesus, show each of us what this means. And we ask all these things in your name, the name of Jesus. Amen. Would you stand with us, please?